Welcome back to the Dirt Show. A few news items before we get to our main subject for today, which is the Trump trial and the obligation imposed by the court on Trump to be at the trial every day, which I'm going to argue was unconstitutional. But before we get to that, a couple of items. Number one, NPR, National Public Radio, some people call it National Palestinian Radio, very hard left. We always knew it was hard left. It was never unbiased. It was never neutral. And I always wondered why the government was financing a biased media. What right does the government have to do to put its thumb on the scale of what kind of news we get? Well, finally, some liberal, a guy named Uri Berliner, some liberal had it up to here. He's been there 25 years, and he wrote an essay. And in the essay, he said, look, NPR has lost its way. It's now, you know, a radical left media outlet. You know, it's like MSNBC, maybe worse in some ways. I've always thought it was that way. But now, apparently, according to Berliner, it's getting even worse. And of course, NPR claimed First Amendment. So what's the first thing they do? They suspended this guy for exercising his free speech rights to criticize NPR. So he's now been suspended without pay by this great First Amendment outlet, NPR, that wants to defend its own First Amendment rights, but won't allow a dissenting 25-year person from NPR to say his thing. Well, he's in violation of some rule of NPR, which requires you to clear in advance, like Pravda requires you to clear in advance with the Communist Party, whatever you're going to say. First of all, let's get it clear. Congress has no legitimate power to allocate money to a news program. None. Read the Constitution. Constitution, remember, Alexander Hamilton argued you didn't need a Bill of Rights because Congress only has limited powers. It has limited powers. And nowhere in the Constitution does it say that Congress has the power to fund a newspaper or to fund, obviously, and the framers didn't know about radio and television, but to fund a media. Now, they do have the power to help the arts and the sciences. Okay. So maybe they can fund a television station or a radio station that plays music or that reads poetry. Okay, you can argue for that. Jonathan Turley has made that distinction. I myself wouldn't do that. I wouldn't have the government fund anything that is related to the arts at all, because even music can be political, as everybody knows. Wagner and Shostakovich was banned by the communists. But I would keep them out of everything. But constitutionally, I don't think they have the power in Congress to make American taxpayers pay for biased news reporting. And remember, NPR, according to this editor who knows 25 years, just misreport story after story. They misreported the entire story of the Russian, you know, involvement in the Trump campaign. They got instructions to do that. They were basically taking a political side. And if you don't agree with that political side, why should your tax money be used to pay for somebody to make a political point that you disagree with? So I think this brave stance, 25 years too late, by this Berliner guy, should be used as a basis for bringing a lawsuit against NPR or against the congressional funders of NPR, challenging Congress's right to put its thumb on the scale of public opinion by financing one side. They don't finance conservative radio. They only finance radical left-wing radio. And that's just wrong. So I'm hoping that people will be inspired to bring a lawsuit. Also, go to Congress. Get Congress to rescind it. Everybody will be in favor of that. Remember who the NPR listeners are. They're elite, left-wing, wealthy people who can afford to have their own station. You want to have another MSNBC that plays music occasionally? Fine, pay for it. Pay for it out of your own pocket, but don't ask conservative Republicans to pay taxes to be used to finance radical leftist propaganda. Take the Israel issue. Again, NPR is widely regarded as National Palestinian Radio. And this is not new. I've been arguing this for 25 years. They wouldn't allow me on to make a pro-Israel statement many, many years ago. I was asked what my position was when I told them what it was. They said they weren't interested in hearing my views. So they don't present both sides of that view. Even if they did present both sides of that view, that's not what the government should be funding. The government should be stopping people from hurting each other on the street. The government should be helping poor people. The government should be doing what the Constitution says. It has a whole list of things that the government is entitled to do. Funding NPR is not one of them. So let's start a campaign to defund NPR. No, don't defund the police. Increase the funding of the police. Use NPR money to help the police. We need more policemen on the street. I never pass a policeman without saying to him, thank you for protecting us. I never pass a military person without thanking him for protecting us and defending us. And so that's where money ought to go, not to NPR, not to National Public Radio, not to NPR television. I like watching a play occasionally on NPR. Fine, I can pay for it. You know, let them have subscriptions or let them do donations. That's all fine. They get a lot of donations. They're a very, very rich station. The last thing the federal government has to spend money on, should spend money on, is news propaganda. And so that's my rant for the day. All right. Having made an anti-left rant, let me now make an anti-right-wing rant. The impeachment of Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas is an exercise in incredible hypocrisy. Who's pushing it? The Republicans, the very Republicans that applauded me when I spoke in front of the Senate on behalf of Donald Trump and said, you can't impeach somebody just for maladministration or not following the law. You need to show treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. They applauded. Wow, that's so right. That's so great. Some of them hugged me. They told me, you know, they listened to me. That was the right argument. Now they're making exactly the opposite argument. They're impeaching Mayorkas on the ground that he failed to enforce the law. That's a good reason for voting against the Democrats. That's a good reason for demanding that Mayorkas be fired. It is not a constitutional basis for impeaching him. He didn't commit a high crime and misdemeanor. If you look at the articles of impeachment, yeah, they sneak in there perjury, but that was just an expression of an opinion. It wasn't perjury. But the idea that you can impeach somebody for failure to enforce the law is exactly what the Republicans argued against in the first impeachment. They don't pass the shoe on the other foot test. And I've written to some of my Republican friends, particularly those who lauded me and applauded me for my argument, saying, why aren't you making my argument now that it doesn't help your party? But we'll see if any of them respond. And if they do, I'll read their responses, or if they allow me to read their responses, I certainly will. I'm really interested in hearing from some principled Republicans and ask them how they can take one position when it comes to Trump, a Republican, and another position when it comes to Mayorkas, a Democrat. I am not a fan of Mayorkas. I'm not a fan of what has been going on in the southern border. I think there's a good reason for having him dismissed, but not impeached, because that creates a precedent. If you can impeach a Democratic cabinet member for failing to administer the law the way you would like to see it administered, then you can next week impeach a Republican for doing the same thing if the Republicans regain the White House. And we'll see what happens if that, because you know what happens, tit for tat. There's going to be, if the Democrats control the House and the Republicans control the White House, you'll see the Democrats start impeaching cabinet members. And then we'll see how all the arguments flip-flop. So, you know, hypocrisy is the national word. E pluribus hypocrisy. That's our motto. Okay. They've seated six jurors. That's interesting. I am told, now I can't confirm this, but I'm told that the judge disqualified all Sabbath observant Orthodox Jews because he didn't want to end the court early on Friday when they have to go home for Shabbos, for Shabbat. You know, he could make the day off on Friday instead of on Wednesday. There's no requirement that it be Wednesday that they take a day off. They could be Friday. The First Amendment requires that you accommodate religious beliefs. And remember that Orthodox Jews, for the most part, tend to be more likely supporters of Republicans than the mass of New York City voters who are 85% Democrat. So if you're excluding a whole group of people who are most likely to be Republicans on religious grounds, that raises serious issues. And it not only involves the right of Donald Trump, it involves the right of the Orthodox religious community to serve on juries. Now, you know, diversity doesn't only involve Black people. It involves Jewish people wearing black hats. And that's what Hasidim wear, the black hats. In fact, in Israel, when you talk about the Hebrew word for black is shachor, when you talk about Black people in Israel, you're talking about Hasidim, because that's the way they describe them there, because they wear all black. And so we may be seeing religious discrimination in the jury selection. Okay, just one more point. Israel announced today that it will make a limited response to Iran's horrible attack, which could easily have killed thousands of people. And I don't believe for one minute the idea that Iran intended it to fail. Iran maybe intended it not to be to kill hundreds of thousands of people, because they did, you know, obviously America knew about it in advance. But when you send ballistic missiles, they are very tough to stop. And some of them landed. I saw a picture of one in the Negev. And they can kill a lot of people. And it was remarkable that every one of them stopped. Look, this is a Chamberlain, Winston Churchill moment. I think this is the time for Israel and the United States, but particularly Israel, to try to destroy Iran's nuclear weapons, arsenal. They already have the rockets. They already have rockets that can have nuclear warheads. All they have to do is throw a few switches and they'll have the ability to put nuclear bombs on ballistic missiles. And some of them, all you need is one to get through. And I think Israel ought to, if they can, destroy Iran's nuclear weapons program. They have perfect right to do it under international law. The attack on Israel was a casus belli, a cause of war. And but if Israel makes the decision not to, it may be doing it because of pressure from Biden administration. It may be doing it because it's not able to now destroy the Iran nuclear weapons program. It may be doing it because it's diverting too much attention to Gaza. But I think history will judge cruelly those who didn't use this opportunity to destroy Iran's nuclear weapons capacity. I would hope, too, that it would be a first step toward regime change. The only way we'll ever get peace in the Middle East is through regime change in Iran. Iran is the Hitler, the Nazis of the 2020s, the Nazis of the 1930s. The Britain and France could have destroyed the Nazi regime in 34 and 35. They didn't. Chamberlain prevailed. Churchill might have done it. What we need now are Churchillian, not leaders who are cowards. Peace for our time or in our time is almost always a segue to an even worse war. Okay, so let's turn to Donald Trump. He has the right to be at his trial. Absolutely. If they tried to ban him from his trial, there would be a constitutional violation. I've argued such cases. I've won such cases. I've argued cases where defendants were barred from just a few minutes of a trial, and the court took seriously that argument, in some cases rules in favor of that argument. So there's no doubt that a defendant has the right to be there, but the government has no constitutional right to make him be there. So there's a statute in New York, and I haven't seen it quoted, and I'm surprised, because the statute does permit a motion to be made to allow a defendant not to be at the trial, for example, to go to his son's graduation or to listen to the Supreme Court very essential argument next Thursday about whether a president has some kind of immunity. And he tried to get that, and the judge said no. And he tried to get permission to go to his son's graduation, and the judge hasn't ruled on it, but made it fairly clear that he'd rule against it. Well, here's the statute. It says, on motion of a defendant, the court may, not must, but may, but here's the critical phrase, the court may, and this was probably put in at the end because it's ungrammatical, the court may, in the absence of an objection by the people, that's the prosecution, issue an order dispensing with the requirement that the defendant be personally present at trial. Such an order may be made only upon the filing of a written and subscribed statement by the defendant declaring that he waives his right to be personally present at the trial and authorizing his attorney to conduct his defense. Well, I'm sure that Trump would sign such a letter allowing him to go to his son's graduation or allowing him to go for a day and campaign in Pennsylvania when Biden is there campaigning in Pennsylvania, a crucial state that could determine the outcome of the election. But the statute says, on motion of defendant, the court may, in the absence of an objection from the people. That's unconstitutional. You can't give that decision unilaterally to the prosecution. That decision should be made by a judge. Even if the prosecution wants him there, they have no right to be there. And his right, his First Amendment right to campaign, his familial right to go to his son's graduation, though that's not protected by the Constitution, but his right to campaign is protected by the Constitution, trumps, yes, trumps any interest of the state in having him at the trial. The state has no interest in having him at the trial for a particular day, maybe if they want him to be identified. But in general, if there's a day that he'd rather be home watching television, he should certainly have the right to do that. But putting that aside, if he's not home watching television, if he's in Pennsylvania campaigning or watching a Supreme Court argument, surely that right prevails over the illegitimate non-interests of the prosecution in having him in the court. So whoever wrote this statute, I'm sure what happened is it was originally written on motion of the defense, the court may issue an order. And then a prosecutor said, no, we want to have a say here. So somebody added, I guarantee you, somebody added the phrase, the court may, in the absence of an objection by the people, unconstitutional. I don't know whether Trump's lawyers are aware of this. I don't know if they've made a motion. Maybe they have. Maybe it's been denied. If it's been denied, it should be appealed, because it seems to me quite clear that a defendant has a constitutional right not to be at his trial. Let me give you a story that occurred in the South many years ago. I heard the story. I've never actually seen the case, so maybe it's apocryphal, but I think it's true. I heard it from a number of sources. So there was a case in the Deep South during the Jim Crow period where a young black man who was like 18 was accused of statutory rape of a young white woman, 17. She consented, but she was under the age of 18. Now, his lawyers knew that no jury in wherever it was, Mississippi or Alabama, would ever convict an 18-year-old white boy of having consensual sex with a 17-year-old white girl. But an all-white jury, and that's what they were in those days, would convict an 18-year-old black young man for having sex with a 17-year-old white young woman. And so the defense told the judge, we're not bringing the defendant in the courtroom. We don't want the jury to know his race. His race is irrelevant legally. And we want a ruling from the judge excluding the fact that he's black. Let the jury decide the case without knowing whether he's white or black. And then they'll do justice. But if they know he's black, they won't do justice. I'm told, again, could be apocryphal, that that worked. And the defendant was acquitted. And the jurors were shocked when they learned that they had acquitted a black man for having sex with a white woman. Oh, my God, what a terrible sin in the South. But it goes to show that it's a defendant's right. He has the right to be there. Implicit in the right to be there is the right not to be there. And so I would expect that his lawyers, Trump's lawyers, would take seriously this statute and at least make the application. You know, he could be there 90% of the time, but this would give him the right to be out of the courtroom on days that he chose to be out of the courtroom. This isn't an all or nothing statute. It doesn't say he has to be out of the courtroom the whole time or in the courtroom the whole time. It says he can be issue an order dispensing with the requirement defendant be personally present at trial. And that means for a day or 2 days or 3 days. And that can be done. Also, you know that the court can exclude somebody for certain purposes. The statute also goes on. A defendant who conducts himself in such a disorderly and disruptive manner that his trial cannot be carried on in the courtroom may be removed from the courtroom, et cetera, et cetera. I was in a case where that happened. You may have heard of the case, Chicago 7 case, where Bobby Seale was excluded from the courtroom. Bobby Seale, a very radical left-wing African-American who now I think is a capitalist, but selling things on television. But if he's still alive, I don't know. I haven't followed his career, but I know that he moved away from his radical ways. But remember, he was gagged and shackled in the courtroom, and it became a big, big deal in the Chicago 7 case. By the way, we're going to have more Chicago 7 cases because Chicago 7 was, remember, 1968 Democratic Convention, Vietnam War. So now we have the 2024 Democratic Convention in Chicago, same Chicago, not a Vietnam War, but a Gaza War. And demonstrators who were yelling death to America. And by the way, they're blocking highways and they're blocking airports and they're probably causing serious disruptions. People could die as a result if an ambulance couldn't get through the Golden Gate Bridge or some other places, the Brooklyn Bridge. People could die as a result of that. And therefore, it's, of course, constitutionally permissible to criminalize the blocking of airports, the blocking of highways, the blocking of bridges, and you know, a bunch of people were arrested, but they were immediately bailed, unlike the January 6th defendants, many of whom were not bailed. So again, we see multiple standards of justice depending on whether it's right or left. But look, we'll see what happens at the Democratic Convention, but I think we'll see some interesting First Amendment challenges. Today, I got a Harvard Law School letter by many of the professors, perhaps even most, saying, oh, we believe in free speech. Everybody should have free speech. But not everybody has free speech at Harvard. I can't speak at Harvard. I've taught there 60 years, taught 10,000 students. And when a group of students asked to have me come and support their rights as Jewish kids to support Israel, not a single organization would invite me to speak because I'm too controversial. Controversial. I mean, yeah, I defended Donald Trump. Yeah, I defended Jeffrey Epstein. Yeah, I believe in the two-state solution, and I'm a moderate on issues regarding the Middle East, but I'm pro-Israel. But I can't speak at Harvard. No organization will invite me, and without an invitation from an organization, I can't speak at Harvard. And so what we're seeing is a completely one-sided application of the First Amendment. Look at what happened the other day. A friend of mine, who is the dean of the Berkeley Law School, Erwin Chemerinsky, was having a dinner at his house for students, and only invited students were there. And anti-Israel people started to demonstrate at the party, trespass on his property. And he tried to throw them off his property, which he's entitled to do. But they said, no, the National Lawyers Guild told us we can protest on your property. This is the same National Lawyers Guild that on October 7th, before Israel sent a single troop into Gaza, said that Hamas did the right thing. They supported Hamas. They supported rapes, murders, beheadings. This is the National Lawyers Guild, one of the most disgusting and disgraceful organizations of lawyers. You know, a lot of lawyers say we're not in there because they defend, they defend Hamas. We're there because they're a good, you know, good left-wing organization. No, you can't do that. They defend Hamas. They support Hamas. They support terrorism. They support the rape and murder of Jewish women. And if you support them, you support that. And yes, the National Lawyers Guild said we can break into somebody's house and protest. That shows you what the National Lawyers Guild knows about of the law. So, you know, we're living in interesting times and we're living in dangerous times and we're living in double standard times. So let's look at some of the letters. I am pro-Israel and I need your help in answering a serious question. What is the legal justification for Israel to bomb Iran's consulate or embassy in Syria? Well, there are two justifications. Number one, Iran bombed Israel's embassy, not consul, embassy in Buenos Aires. So who is there to complain about that? Iran bombed Israel's actual embassy, killed 23 innocent people. So I don't think they have standing to complain when a building, which was an annex to a consular building, not even part of the embassy, and which was being used not for diplomatic purposes, but for military planning purposes, including one of the people who was killed, apparently being involved in the planning of the October 7th massacres. If you're a legitimate military target, the enemy can come after you if you're in a building near an embassy or near the consulate. So what Israel did was 100% legitimate. Now let's compare that to sending 330 drone ballistic missiles and cruise missiles with explosive warheads capable of killing hundreds of thousands of people. And if they hadn't been knocked out of the air by the United States, Israel, Jordan, France, they would have done horrible damage, including possibly blowing up the Al-Aqsa Mosque. You should see the pictures of the Iron Dome or whatever, the arrow, whatever defensive weapon Israel or America used. It was Israel because it was over Jerusalem. They were sending rockets to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a civilian place. It's not a military base. They were sending rockets. Iran was sending rockets designed to kill Israelis, and they almost hit the Al-Aqsa Mosque. If they had, I can imagine what Iran would have done. It would have tried to blame it on Israel, of course. But if an Iranian rocket had destroyed the Al-Aqsa Mosque, I think that probably would have been the end of that regime. But they didn't, because the Israeli technology was superior and managed to bring down. A friend of mine who lives in Jerusalem had part of an Iranian rocket land in his front yard as shrapnel from one of the rockets that was knocked down. It could easily have been a rocket that landed in his backyard, killing his entire family, because the rockets contained thousands of pounds of explosives. So no, what Israel did was 100% lawful, and what Iran did was 100% unlawful. Could Trump have removed this case to federal court? No. It's a state case and it can't be removed to federal court, even though it involves a former president. Your explanation of the rule of proportionality makes perfect sense. Thank you. That's nice. There's likely a fourth group. I mentioned three groups of people who participate in these demonstrators. And he says a fourth group, those paid to meet community organizers. I agree with you. There are paid organizers who bring these things together. And of course, the events of yesterday in eight cities was very well coordinated and probably a criminal conspiracy, because it was an organized effort to commit crimes by blocking highways and airports. Would bunker-busting bombs be able to destroy Iran's nuclear facility and cause little or no harm to the general population? Yes, bunker-busting bombs go down. The nuclear facilities in Iran are buried under 80 meters of dirt, and the bunker-busting bombs can get them. Of course, some of them are probably hidden under hospitals. And so that, you know, raises the same issue as is raised by the use of civilian shields. So we live in a complicated world and things are not getting better. And maybe I'll have a little bit more positive news to report tomorrow. See you then.